necessitate a smaller bureaucracy, a little more efficient. Let's take a look at the communist. The communist says, means holding in common, hogwash. It means dictatorship of the proletariat. It means a small clique of 36 men in the Soviet Union owning everything. Let's take a look at what communism really is. All means of production are owned and controlled by the state. The consumer has no choice between where to go to buy imports, no choice of the sale of exports. There's no choice of where to work. All products and all production is in this monopoly in the hands of the state. All finances, monopoly. All communications, a monopoly, a total monopoly. No control at all by the consumer pressure on anything. All farms, farm machinery. But more than this, the communist says that the whole state is one vast productive plant. It is one factory unit. That means everything in the state is a productive unit to serve the state. Now, let's take a look what this means. This means that as any businessman knows, he buys a machine when it's new and efficient, tolerances are high, and it's the latest thing. It's used in first-line production at a high price output. And the machine now has a very high price, doesn't it? As the machine gets old and sloppy and gets out of date, it's put in second-line production, and its value drops, doesn't it? And the day that machine cannot produce enough to pay to have a worker stand by and run it, and won't pay for electricity and so forth because it no longer will hold tolerances enough or is so obsolete it can't compete against a new machine, what do we do with it? You throw it in a scrap heap. Notice when the human being now is looked upon as a productive unit, he must be measured and controlled like you control any productive unit, raw materials or any other machine. That means that the human being now must be recreated, educated, and trained to serve the state in his productive capacity. He cannot be influenced by moral concepts and religious concepts that would make him less efficient in the serving of the state and being happy and staying in his indicated role of production. Notice when he is young and capable of producing an awful lot, he might be able to live fairly well. But as his productivity drops, in order to get a profit off the man, you must reduce what you give him. Until the point comes that this person no longer is producing a profit for the state, even in a slave labor camp, then he's exterminated. For no longer is he useful. It would be a waste to society to maintain people who are consuming more than they're producing. And seeing, once you get to a total dialectic materialism, that there is nothing but just material goods, there is no God, there's no hereafter, there's no purpose, why not exterminate the useless? We do this with old cattle. Why not do it with old people? Notice if a person gets ideas of individual ideas in which he no longer cooperates good with the state, he has to be eliminated because he's inefficient. He had a breakdown. His electronic circuitry went wrong. And so what is you got in communism is total capitalism. Everything is a capital item. The human being now no longer is a person. He is a capital item. What communism is total capitalism. It's to look upon everything as a capital item. It is total oligarchy, and it's total monopoly, and it's total fascism. In fact, it is fascism, capitalism, oligarchic monopoly carried to its ultimate extreme. It is the most the furthest possible of monopoly, oligarchy, capitalism, and fascism. We can't even conceive of a more fascistic, monopolistic, capitalistic oligarchy. And what do you have here? Monopolistic, capitalistic oligarchy, a monopolistic, capitalistic oligarchy, a monopolistic, capitalistic oligarchy, and a monopolistic, capitalistic oligarchy. For a monopolist cannot exist without oligarchy. This is why we do not find the super rich fighting communism, but supporting it. For there's only one enemy of a monopolist. What is it? A competitor. The only enemy of a monopolist is a competitor. Competitive capitalism is his enemy, and always has been. Competitive capitalism can only exist in a republic. And a republic can only exist where competitive capitalism is the economic system, where the government does not give the advantage to one producer over another. And government is not the instrument by which man obtains wealth, but production is the instrument by which he obtains wealth. When government is the way in which you get rich, by a government contract or subsidy or financing, or you get a government to pass a law to allow you to establish your monopoly, government now becomes dictatorial, oppressive, and you have an oligarchy. You must have one. There are only two forms of government man can live under. This is not a government. It's a fast, hot road to oligarchy. This is an oligarchy. I'll show you that later. But it always is a small clique which runs two sets of candidates for the people to go down and pull the little levers for. It makes you think that you're running a government. How many people here think that last November you really decided the affairs of the United States? Is there anybody here who really thinks by going down pulling a few levers you really decided the things in Vietnam, all the problems in our society? And do you think that there's been any change at all in policy? Richard Nixon has done nothing but intensify the total program of Lyndon Baines Johnson. There can't be, for both of the members, both of them belong to the same organization headed and organized by the Rockefellers. And always have. Richard Neilhouse Nixon is a CFR member, and he writes for the magazine, for an example, let's take a look at some CFR members. This is a Council for Foreign Relations created in 1919 by employees of Rockefeller, Christian Herter, Alan Dulles, John Foster Dulles, and the boys. We have people like Dewey, Stevenson, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Nixon, Johnson, Hubert Horatio Humphrey. You can get Tweedledee or Tweedledum Humphrey anytime you want them. They put both of them up for the show, and they put up, those same people have put up both candidates for both parties in every election of this century, without exception. Without exception. And I know you're thinking back now, clicking along. We can get into that a little later. But I just want to wrap this up. There are only two economic systems possible. You're either going to live under a competitive capitalistic system or some form of monopolistic capitalistic system. We can put feudalism and other things in here. There are only two systems. One system, one side, the economic side, is monopolistic capitalism. And the other side is an oligarchy, the political side of that coin. But it's the same coin. It's a system. There's another coin, another system, which the political side is a republic and the economic side is competitive capitalism. You're either going to live under some form of monopolistic capitalistic oligarchy or a competitive capitalistic republic. There aren't any others, and never have been, nor can there ever be. And that kind of simplifies, I think, the whole thing down from 256 forms of government to two. And for that, let's have lunch. Let me warn you again of something where so many people who hear this talk make a mistake in their thinking. And that is that I'm attempting to educate you. I'm not. I'm attempting only to give you a broad overview of a problem so that you, and as you educate yourself, can put the different pieces into perspective, into context. This is only really kind of a roadmap and not intended to be any thorough education. And I have here one little book I meant to mention before lunch, and you will find that they will be sold out in a matter of a few minutes because they do not have a note from an audience of this size, excuse me, it fell down, that it will sell approximately double of what there are, what we have available. But if you would leave your name back there when they run out and give them a dollar, they will send you a copy just by putting your name on a card. And that is a little book called The Law, written by Frederick Bastiat 120 years ago. Could we cut out the discussion a little bit, please? Please, if there's anything really important and you'd like to bring it up, let's stand up and get the announcement done. Otherwise, let's wait until the break, please. The law was written, I say, 120 years ago, and a lot of people would like me to write this first part of the speech, and I really think it's a waste of time, because everything I have said is in this little book. In fact, he has done it so well and so concisely in a very short little book with a nice large print, easy to read. You can read it in an hour and a half, no difficulty. He puts the whole thing that I have talked about in this morning in a nutshell, so beautifully and so succinctly, I don't know how anybody could improve upon it. And remember, this man is a member of the French Parliament. 120 years ago, this was known. These ideas aren't new. In fact, the ideas are something we have lost and a treasure we better refine. If I could be king for a day and make a law that everybody had to obey forever and then be deposed and shot tomorrow, my law would be that no one could get a high school diploma
unless they understood this book, not agreed with it, understood it, I'd have no fear for this nation or any nation. For the population understood the principles so clearly laid down in this book, it'd be impossible for a dictator in that society. The reason why dictators can rise is because the people have made a key mistake of thinking that government solves problems. Government creates them. People don't enslave people. Governments enslave people. People don't go to war. Governments go to war. Not people. Not nations. Governments. Let's take a few little rules of political science. Rule number one, in my summation here. During periods of war, governments always increase their power. Two, history shows that the more powerful a government, the greater chance of it going to war. It goes to war more often. Three, since war increases the power of government, the more powerful governments have a greater propensity to war. War breeds war. And dictatorship. Four, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It is power that corrupts government. No man is worthy or can be trusted with power. There is no man so noble that he can be entrusted with dictatorial power. Never has been, and if there was one, he wouldn't be. And he did. We can go over a few more. Power is never created. Power is only transferred. If you have the power to decide where you're going to work, then the government doesn't have the power to decide where you're going to work. If the government has the power to decide where you're going to work, you don't have the power to decide where you're going to work. When you have the power, it's a liberty. When the government has it, it's a lost liberty. Every increase of power of government is a decrease of liberty of the citizens. When the government has all power, the citizens have no liberty. The power of government is therefore inversely proportional to the liberty of the citizens. All you have to do to lose your liberty is to ask government to increase its power. You let government, any government, increase its control, and you become its slave. The enemy of liberty is always government. He governs best who governs least. When you look to the solutions of problems to government, you must give to government the power to rule you. When you look to government for your subsistence, it becomes your master and you its slave. We'll go even further. In the insurance business, we talk about a thing called friendly and unfriendly fires. Now, a friendly fire is in the furnace. When that same fire gets out of the furnace and starts running up your wall and your draperies, it's called an unfriendly fire. Notice, it's both fire. It's all the same thing. It isn't a matter of whether it is fire or not. It's whether it is your servant or your master. Government properly limited and contained to the proper just functions is a friendly government. When government is allowed to expand its affairs beyond those of protecting life, liberty, and property, it becomes an unfriendly government. It is at best a dangerous servant, and at worst a fearful master. The purpose of maintaining liberty, or the whole goal of maintaining liberty, is to keep government contained and make it a servant, not your master. It does not supply your needs. It only protects your right to earn your own need. This is what government is to be. This is the difference between a republic and a democracy. A democracy, the government says, you can live off of everybody. Everybody can live off of everybody else. It's a fraud. It's impossible. A child knows better. Again, it takes 20 years in order to buy that malarkey of indoctrination. Anybody who tells you that you can get that somehow, youth have been given this impression that the things they live off of come magically, somehow by a productive system or something or other, you know. by something called society. There is no such thing as society. There are people, individual people. There isn't anything else. There's no such thing called mass, group, society, community. There are people. And as long as you want to keep talking about this mass society, then it may lead you to go into this very dangerous, deceptive self-deception of trying to manipulate and come up with grandiose schemes of how you can force other people to do the wonderful things you know they should be doing. Notice that every liberal comes up with the idea that he knows best what you should do, and you're going to do it or else. The key to every liberal program is to force you to comply to what the liberal says is right. It's true. I don't like to use the word conservative, because I'm not trying to conserve the present system. I am a true libertarian. I am for the overthrow of the present system. The liberal, the true liberal, is a conservative. He wants to conserve the present system of robbery, but he can't conserve it because it's got to get worse. You see, there's no way to maintain a half a state of socialism. For the number of people to robbing must always increase, and the number of people being robbed must decrease until collapse. There is no preserving it. You cannot hold at the present degree of socialism. It cannot be held. It must go one way or the other. You either have to reduce it or it will increase. No stagnation or status quo is possible. I have another thing, a piece of philosophy I'd like to give to you. I think all things that happen because somebody made them happen. And I think if you don't like what's happening, then you better do something to make something else happen. And if you don't do anything to make something else happen, it isn't going to. And sitting and wishing isn't going to make it so. You can sit around and spitball and read all the books you want and become the best educated person in the concentration camp. To me, that's a waste of time. I don't want to know how I got there. By the way, this is the period of making announcements, and I got off the track here. There is going to be, down in San Diego, a picnic with Mr. Robert Welch as guest of honor. Sometime I had something here told me all about it. Oh, here it does. On Sunday, July 20th, 1969, the 5th Annual John Birch Society picnic at 10 a.m. in the Big Oak Ranch, Frontier Town. Somebody... All right, I got that one there. Now, I did do the location of the restrooms. They are down the hall for those who missed that one. There are some theater party tickets. I don't know what that is, but I imagine they're available in the back. We will, at the end of this meeting, have coffee in the back and punch on both sides. So I hope to handle you a little quicker that way. There is, in the back of the room as you go out, tables, coordinator tables. If you have any questions about the society and you want to talk to members of the staff, they will be located at the tables, at the literature tables, of course, at the back. I don't need to tell you about the need for a ticket for lunch. Obviously, I can skip that one. So there we are. We've got the, I think, the business taken care of. And again, let me reiterate that if you want a text of my morning's talk, just read the law. It's right there for a buck. If you do it an hour and a half, and half the time you can listen to the tape. So with that, let's move on to our next subject of the day. And that is, we've covered political science and economics. Let's cover a course of history. Now, the history I'm going to give you is not the history you've got in school. In fact, very little of it you've ever heard of before, unless you've done some digging. And those who have done the digging know where I'm getting my material from. Let's look at history itself as a, quote, science, end quote. You always hear these people saying, well, here's an objective history. What an excellent objective history. There's never been an objective history. There never will be one. There can't be one by the very nature of history. You see, any history you'll be written about anything has to be a very, very small percentage of the total information and events available. And events and information available is a very, very tiny bit of the actual events. that really took place. And the real history isn't really the events that took place, but the causes of the events which were decided in the back room that nobody knows about or isn't talking about. The vast quantity of historical data can never possibly be recorded. Any history which is written by the very nature is a highly selected events for reporting. Well, I'm going to assume something here, and again, this is a false assumption, and that is that the histories that are being taught in our schools today are true. That's a real strange assumption, as anybody could recognize by reading one of them. But my point is that I think they are not pertinent. They do not explain what has happened or give a proper information for prediction of future events. What I say is they are guilty of omission of the more important events. Now, I'm going to grant to my opposition the fact of, let's say, accuracy of the reporting. What I am going to contend is what they have reported is not important. But the events which they have omitted and that they know about are important. Now, getting back to my idea of an objective history, the reason there can't be any is that out of all the information available, any historian is forced to select only certain events for reporting. How does he select the events? Well, he selects the ones he considers important. Which ones are important to any historian? Those events that support a thesis, a theory he has of why the history took place. Notice, he has to have a theory before he has the historical events. For otherwise, he has no way to select the events to include in his history. Therefore, his history are events to prove his theory right, which he had in the first place to select the events to prove his theory right. His theory has to be right. No other course is possible, regardless of how wrong his theory is. What I am going to say is that the history I'm going to give you is totally non-objective. I have selected the events not at random, but because they support a theory I hold. I am the only historian I've ever heard who made that admission. All historians do it. But you know, you're not supposed to admit these things. It's like when the doctor gives you the placebos. That's candy-coated candy pills that you pay $5 for a dozen for, you know. In the Army, you had four kinds of aspirin, depending whether your temperature was high, low, or normal, or you just weren't walking right. One of the two. Let's take a look at a little history. And we'll start out, I can start at different places, but let's move back to about 1850. In 1848, a plagiarist hired by Theodore Roosevelt, Horace Greeley, and some of the boys over here, financed a guy named Karl Marx to write a book called The Communist Manifesto. He came out with this little book, which has in it a 10-point program for taking over developed nations. The second plank of that program is the necessity of a graduated personal individual income tax, without which you could not extract the money and gain the control you needed over the individual. The eighth plank is more important, or equally important, and that is that you could never really extract wealth without a central bank. The central bank is essential. Now, in the 1850s, only two nations, major nations, of the Western world did not have a central bank. France had the Bank of Rothschild. England had the Bank of Rothschild. Italy had the Bank of Rothschild. Austria had the Bank of Rothschild. Germany had the Bank of Warburg, cousins of the Rothschilds. Holland had the Bank of Warburg, cousins of the Rothschilds. You know, they had a nice little game going, see? It's kind of called a monopoly, an international monopoly in money. But two nations, they were not able to milk and control because they didn't have a central bank. They had private, basically small, local banking system. That one nation was a newly emerging nation called the United States of America, which was becoming, or looking like, the coming financial giant, which might overpower the banking interest in Europe. It was decided, and Bismarck makes this statement, that it was decided in the House of Rothschild that the United States had to be split up in the 1850s. By the way, a representative of the House of Rothschilds in the United States was a man named Jefferson Davis, an interesting individual. Another one was E. Mandel House's father, who I'll come in a little later. You can stick that one in the background, in the back of your head. But they were decided that the United States had to be broken up so that it could be controlled better. The other nation without a central bank was Russia, under Tsar Alexander II. Now, in 1860, they allowed in the North a man to become president of the United States, and this is actually the correct statement, allowed, because they considered him not very bright and very easy to control. A backwoods hick farmer lawyer named Abraham Lincoln. Figured they could sure work around this guy, but no trouble. In claiming an issue of slavery, but basically that was not the cause of the war. The actual cause of the war was never a question of slavery, but a question of tariffs. The South was for low tariffs, the North was for high tariffs. This was the major friction between the North and the South. Anyway, the states seceded. Abraham Lincoln, in his whole lifetime, never called the Civil War a civil war. He called it a rebellion. He never recognized the secession of any state. He said the Union was always in existence, and even the Supreme Court came out with that decision in 1878 in White versus State of Texas. That no state ever seceded in law. Now, if this being the case, what Lincoln said, the war was being fought for, was not ending slavery. What was his whole reason for fighting the war? To preserve the Union. That is, Lincoln knew that if the South seceded, separated itself from the Union, that Virginia, remember, had already separated itself individually, separately. There was already three nations. Texas was ready to secede in a fourth nation. It would break off. California and the West Coast, being far away at that time and isolated from the rest of the nation, would form a fifth nation. New England would break away from the Central Atlantic states, forming a sixth nation, and Midwest, west of the Appalachians, would break into a seventh nation. And you would have seven little countries easy to play against each other, like they've been playing the game in Europe for ages. You see, in Europe, there's always been a game. Now, we all know what a pawn shop is. A pawn shop's the poor man's bank. He takes his collateral down, he takes out a loan, doesn't he, at the loan office. Only his is a poor man's bank. There is a credit union, that's a working man's bank. There's a commercial bank we see in the corner, that's the merchant's, the businessman's bank. There's the investment bankers, that's the corporation's bank. And there is the international banker, that's the bank that finances governments. You see, for every need, there's an institution to serve the need. Now, of course, if you think there's such a thing as an international banker, you must be a kook. You're not supposed to even think of such things. It's not for us plebes to even inquire into. But let's take a look at the oldest game of princes. The oldest game of princes is to spend more money than they take in and run debt. Now, they first try to cover their deficits by the major practice of all history, and that is clipping the coin of the realm. Shortchanging the quantity of gold and silver in the coin. It's called inflation. After they can only do so much of that, it doesn't work so much anymore. They have to go and borrow the money. From whom? From the people? No, they've already taken all of that. If they want to borrow money, they've got to take it somewhere else. From people who can loan money to governments. Well, that isn't the local pawn shop. That's the local Rothschild. Now, you see, the banker has the problem. When the international banker loans to a prince, how does he get his money back? What if the prince says, I don't want to pay off with your head? You've got to have a way of collecting from a prince. How do you collect from a prince? What is the weapon you hold over a prince? Another prince. The only weapon you have. In other words, you must have another prince of sufficient strength that if you finance a second prince, he can punish the first prince. This means that you always have to, after every so-called war, see that the nations are lined up in a balance of power, so that both sides have approximately equal strength, so that your financing, switching from one side to the other, will be able to assure your collection and keep the proper taxes being collected and paid over in the interest payments on the debt that was accrued in the wars the prince got himself into, or you got him into, in order to assure your collections. Now, this has been a game going down through history in Europe. Always after every war, remember, there's always the balance of power. And who are the two centers? At first, it was the Rothschild Bank in Austria and France, and then switched from France and England, right? Always had to be in the center of the two camps, so that the switching of small amounts would be able to tip the scales and punish either side that got out of line. And everybody knew they could be punished, so everybody stayed in line. Otherwise, you can't collect your money right. Now, I'm not just talking about the Rothschilds. There were others earlier, because Rothschilds aren't that old, going back. But they became very important in the 19th century. Now, you couldn't play this game with the United States and Russia, because they didn't have debt. The United States was out of debt. Didn't have any, basically. How do you collect the money from the taxpayers and melt them unless there's debt so you can legally collect it? Well, you have to get the nation into debt first. How do you get it into debt? War. War gets a nation into debt. Therefore, now the people may be taxed legally and transferred as interest payments to the banks. Without wars and debts, you can't take the money away from them. Now, let's see how the history kind of moved along. The South seceded. Lincoln committed the act of war, knowingly, that is. South Carolina, the first state to secede, has stated that it was not their intention to commit any aggressive act against the United States of America, and that they would not insist upon the withdrawal of Union forces from the state of South Carolina, as long as those forces were not reinforced. For if they were reinforced, there could be only one reason why the Union would reinforce forces within the state of South Carolina, and that would be for an aggressive act against the state of South Carolina. Therefore, South Carolina declared that as long as the Union did not change the present situation, then they would consider no act of war. But if the Union decided to increase its military forces within the state of South Carolina, it would be considered an act of war against the state of South Carolina. Lincoln knowingly, because he was against the breakup of the Union and realized that the breakup of the Union would be the destruction of the liberty of the American people, and put them in the control of the same forces that were controlling Europe, sent relief ships to Fort Sumter, which was trying to reinforce Fort Sumter, and, of course, the state of South Carolina opened fire, and we had the start of this conflict, which he called the rebellion. Now, as the problem with the conflict, it didn't work right. It seemed like this guy up there in that White House wasn't playing ball. He didn't put the country in debt. He financed the war internally from the taxpayers by very strong and ruthless methods, for sure. But he was not going to borrow any money and put the United States in debt to the very people he was trying to keep it out of the control of. They expected that the North would have to come to Europe to borrow the finances in order to fight the war. Lincoln refused. He fought a war internally. He was not cooperating and being very nice. And so by 1863, it was decided that the North had to be punished. France landed their armies in Mexico and took Mexico and put Maximilian on the throne and put the French armies on the Rio Grande ready for the invasion of the United States. It was already decided that Louisiana and Texas would go to France, that the rest of the South would be an independent nation, and England was already marshaling its troops on the St. Lawrence for an invasion of the North. War was now imminent. In order to assure victory, England had pushed through in Europe an international law requiring that no blockade would be legal unless a warship was stationed every 3 miles on the enemy's coastline. And therefore, it would not be illegal for any nation to run a blockade unless the blockade was legal. And it could not be illegal unless there was a ship every 3 miles. You see, in Holland, that wouldn't be very difficult. But for the United States or the South, all the way from Maryland, around Florida, and all the way to Texas, through Mexican border, that's a lot of ships. No nation in the world could possibly put a legal blockade. So what did Lincoln do? He commissioned every private yacht, every tugboat, the ferry boats in New York. He commissioned everything that floated, put a gun on it, put a flag on it, a naval officer, and called it the ship of the line. He put a ship every 3 miles from Maryland to Mexico. England was faced with a problem now. She could not run the blockade legally. Lincoln had thwarted them twice. So they were building warships, selling them supposedly to private citizens in France, who were selling them to private citizens in the South to run the blockade, to supply arms to the South and to get the cotton out that England needed. English sympathies were strong with the South. War was now imminent. In February 1963, Ambassador Adams of the United States issued to the British government our declaration of war. It was worded this way, that if the Alhambra, which was laying in the ways on the Thames, the moment it hit the water, a state of war existed. Lincoln knew that England had every intention of launching that ship, and the war was unavoidable. There was only one way out to preserve the Union, something that he was personally opposed to. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just saying that this was the condition of this at the time. He was opposed to the freeing of the slaves. He always had been. He was for the returning of the Negro to Africa, as he had promoted before with the establishment of the nation Liberia in Africa. But he issued the Emancipation Proclamation knowing that English sympathy was strongly anti-slavery and saw that the notice of that Emancipation Proclamation arrived in England just 1 week before the launching of the Alhambra. A 500,000 British citizens started marching in front of the Parliament, and England, or the government, was forced 2 hours before the launching, and a state of war would open between the United States and England, to issue orders to prohibit the launching of the Alhambra, which stayed on the ways the rest of the war. They were never launched. Now, conditions were still bad. There was a second reason why England retreated from her position, and that was that the Imperial Russian Navy arrived in New York on a state visit for 2.5 years to reinforce the Union fleet, to be able to cut British supplies to the St. Lawrence. England had expected the whole United States Navy, of course, to be tied up in the blockade and could not defend the North. But with the Imperial Russian fleet in the hands of Abraham Lincoln and the Pacific Russian Imperial fleet arriving in San Francisco on a state visit, the situation changed. France withdrew her position on the Mexican border, and England decided to wait the war out and work the other way around. By the way, Abraham Lincoln was shot down by a Marxist anarchist, and so was Alexander II of Russia. They weren't playing ball, right? But the Czars were going to get it later. And so was the United States. Now let's take a look at some other little interesting things. In 1880, there was a cartel established to control 100% of the marketing of oil and petroleum products in Western Europe. That cartel was established between Royal Dutch Shell, now headed by Prince Bernhard, the House of Orange, and Standard Oil, of Rockefeller fame. Since that time, in 90 years, no one has yet been able to break that monopoly. They control 100% of the oil product sales in Europe. Now, let's take a look at something historically. It's very important. Let me digress for just a moment. In French, that is not a boa serpent that swallowed the ponderous pachyderm from La Petite France. That is a berge, or hill. Now, on top of the berge, on the hill, people used to live who were called aristocrats or nobles. You know? Now, these people, down in the valley, lived a bunch of people farming along called serfs. Some people would even call slaves, see? Now, these people farmed down here. They couldn't own property in a true communal society. Buy or sell. They produce according to their need, given to according to their, or produce according to the ability, given to according to their need, and all this. And the guy up in the bourge owned everything. He liked it that way. You see? But you know, something happened. Around on the hillside, some people who were called hillsiders, that is, bourgeoisie, started building little things like shops, offices, little businesses. This became a town. It built around, of course, the castle because it was a fort and place of protection, and also it was in the center of the community, and also because it was on the hill, which wasn't as valuable for farmland. And so the bourgeoisie, the hillsiders, that is, the middle class, started to develop. But a problem arose. The serf provided food to the bourgeoisie needed, and the bourgeoisie provided services and manufactured goods and so forth the serf wanted. There developed a natural economic course, a flow between the two. The two had a mutual interdependence, but they didn't need the guy on top of the hill. The guy on top of the hill liked being on top of the hill, and in order to keep on top of the hill, he played an old game that we've all played as kids. And when we wanted to cut out one guy out of the gang, we turned other people against him. You know this thing? We've all seen that operate. They always incited the serf that their enemy was the exploiting bourgeoisie, and constantly fomented agitation amongst the serf against the middle class. Notice the communists are not out after the super rich. They're after the bourgeoisie, the middle class. And notice who finances. There's one thing about the communist movement. You'll notice the financing comes from the economic elite. That the promotion and training comes from the intellectual elite, not the uneducated. Communism is never led by the uneducated, but by the elite, the aristocracy of the educated class. Right? And if you want to think, not by the social nobodies, but the social elite. And not by the political nobodies, but the political elite. Communism is always a movement of the elite, who consider themselves an aristocracy, using the proletariat as the cannon fodder, maintaining their superiority over the bourgeoisie, to keep the bourgeoisie in line. For the bourgeoisie would become the natural leaders of this economic system, and cut out the aristocracy. This is as old as feudalism. And you will find today, who is running our government? What kind? Poor people? Who are pushing the left? Oh no. Is it the uneducated that are out pushing the doctrines of Marx? Oh no. The intellectual elite. It is an aristocracy who considers themselves superior. And if you ever meet these guys, the Marxist college professor, he considers himself superior and ordained to rule. And you thwart him and watch his anger. You watch his anger. This is an old game. Nothing really new there. But just want to get the language straightened out. Okay, so he can get something. Let's take a look and see how some of our elite is operating. In 1880, the United States of America produced 86% of the world's oil. Russia produced 6%. And 8% by the rest of the world. Let's look at 1900. 43% for the United States. Not that there was a drop in national production, but a drop in relative production because of the great increase in world production. Where was that increase in world production? Russia, 53%, 52.8 to be more accurate. That's called a competitor. 4% for the rest of the world. Something has to be done about this Russia bit, doesn't it? And the boys are ready for action, and they got something. Well, let's take a look and see how this action develops.
In 1900, a man arrives in the United States named Mr. Warburg. Mr. Warburg, his biographers tell him, he died a few years ago. He's on the board of directors of 65 of the world's largest corporations, considered Mr. Banker in the United States, one of the wealthiest men in the world. Let's look at the biography of Mr. Warburg and put in a few pieces they left out. In the biography, they say that Mr. Warburg arrived in the United States as a poor little immigrant boy from Germany with nothing but the clothes in his bank and a grocery sack. What they neglected to mention that is in the grocery sack, Mr. Warburg had $1 million in U.S. cash. And that Mr. Warburg's family owned the Bank of Germany and the Bank of Holland. And were cousins of the Rothschilds. Now, outside of that little fact, which was overlooked in the biography, let's see what Mr. Warburg did. Did this poor little immigrant push apples down Fifth Avenue selling apples? No, he didn't. He went around the nation giving lectures on the necessity of a central bank. Eighth plank of Karl Marx, right? By 1907, the American people were not buying. And so, the Morgans, the Schiffs, the Loebs, the Kuhn, the international bankers in New York, withdrew their money from American banks. By the way, in 1904, the Rockefellers bought the largest bank in New York, Chase Manhattan. John D. did. And his brother William bought New York City Bank, second largest bank. They pulled their money out, took it to Canada. The withdrawal of their funds caused a bank panic and a crash, a depression and unemployment. And the American people were taught a lesson. You're going to have a central bank because you're going to need one. And so, when the lesson was properly learned, the money came back. Let's go back to something else here. Between 1870 and 1914, the most rapidly industrializing nation in all of Europe. Notice I didn't say the most industrialized. I said the most rapidly industrializing was Russia. You see, not internally. The Tsar had invited in foreign capital to be invested in Russia. The French built the Trans-Siberian Railroad. The Harrimans of the United States built the Western Railroads. The Germans built the steel industry and the canal systems. The Nobels of Norway developed the Caucasian oil fields. They had this oil. And they were competitors of the Rockefeller Royal Dutch Shell cartel. It's interesting that the Soviet Union has indemnified only two people for property expropriated. See, almost all industrial property in Russia was owned foreign-owned, under concession from the Tsar. Only two were ever indemnified for the loss of property, 1 cent, and they were indemnified 100 cents in gold by the communist government in Russia, the Harrimans and the Schiffs, Jacob Schiff. 100 cents on a dollar. How come? Those are dirty capitalists, weren't they? Why were they paying off these dirty capitalists? The Nobels didn't get a penny. Not a sou for over half the world's oil production. Could there be this little something funny going on? Well, anyway, let's get back to the ranch here and see what else the other boys are up to. 1912. In 1912, we had a lot of very important things. The Rockefellers are buying interest in a place called Abi Edan, worthless to it because it was part of the Ottoman Empire, Turkish Empire, and they couldn't exploit it because they wouldn't let infidels do so. But remember, the First World War came along, and Abi Edan becomes Edan, major refinery of Standard Oil. And with all the riots and revolutions over there, nobody ever shoots up Standard Oil's Edan refineries. Isn't that interesting? Well, those are all peculiar. Everything I'm giving you is circumstantial. I want you to understand. And I'm not going to prove a thing. I'm just going to tell you what the events. Now, they haven't proven anything. They could be, but they're just bad shots. So now, let's go and take a look and see what the other boys are up to. We had a direct election of senators. Very necessary. You see, when the senators were appointed by the state governments, the federal government couldn't increase its power because they had to get approval of the state governments, that is, the senators appointed by the state governments. And they could be removed if they ever allowed the federal government to increase their power. They had to get around this to centralize the power in the federal government. The direct election of senators removed any control of the state governments over the federal government and now allowed demagoguery to operate in full swing. A third thing necessary in order to melt the American people, of course, was the personal individual income tax. A man named McKinley had tried to block the idea of a central bank. He got shot down in Niagara Falls, president of the United States, if you remember. But in 1912, we had a man named Bernard Baruch come in and finance two men for the president in the same election. One was Woodrow Wilson on the Democratic ticket, and the other was Teddy Roosevelt on the Bull Moose ticket. Teddy Roosevelt's job was to take away the votes from William Howard Taft, who was a sure winner, to allow Woodrow Wilson to win with a minority of votes. And nobody protested that, did they? Yeah, that was quite all right. Because Woodrow Wilson happened to be a member of the Fabian Socialist Society as early as 1888. But getting back to the game of what was happening in 1912, Bernard Baruch financed two men. One of the men, which was a spoiler, and the other one to be elected, Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson, of course, was going to keep us out of war, wasn't he? But he made Bernard Baruch head of War Production Board. Bernard Baruch put 1,800 millions of dollars worth of federal contracts through Baruch's own industries, netting himself over $400 million from personal after-tax profits. Now, bad for uplifting downtrodden and taking care of the poor, you know. He'll come back later. I just thought we'd shoot that in while we had a few minutes here to waste. Let's see what else was happening in 1912, where the boys really playing the game really hot. Warburg personally writes a bill called the Federal Reserve Act to set up a private bank, privately owned. The Federal Reserve Bank is not owned by the government. And that private bank today owns your money. It isn't U.S. money. It's Federal Reserve Bank money. A private bank issues that money and controls all credit and all finances and the destinies of the people of the United States. Now, who was the first president of the Federal Reserve Bank? Mr. Warburg. Isn't that interesting? Well, we'll get to more later. Now, what was this? This was a monopoly bank to make sure that you dirty customers don't go from one bank to another and get a better deal. You're going to have the same interest rates, the same rediscount rates, and the same total control over the finances, and new customers are going to pay what you were told to pay. And all your credit and financing and your business success or failure is going to depend upon your financing from banks controlled by a central source. You see, you must combine them together in order to properly control them. By law, only government can make out the edicts, right? Now, we had a Federal Reserve Bank. Let's take a look. Well, we saw the First World War come along, and we won't get too much into the First World War. Let me see what else happened in 1913 of great importance. That was a great year for events. But let's move on along to 1917. You see, the British opened the Dardanelles campaign, which purpose was to take away the oil fields from the Ottoman Empire and to deliver them to separate protectorates, which could be controlled by, guess who? They did. Anyway. The problem was now Russia. What to do? In 1905, they tried a little show over there and it backfired. So they tried a new one. Here, Kerensky in May overthrew the Tsar. Lenin is sitting in Switzerland, unable to pay his room rent, can't even buy a sandwich. And all of a sudden, Max Warburg in Holland makes available to Lenin and deposits to his bank account $50 million in U.S. cash. While the German government, happy to ship Lenin to St. Petersburg, because, you see, Lenin promised that if he overthrew Kerensky, he would sign a separate peace treaty in violation of the Allies' agreements and release German divisions from the Eastern Front to kill Americans on the Western Front, like Vietnam. So anyway, Lenin arrives, the Germans deliver him to St. Petersburg, and then a man, a bit Hollywood actor, leaves New York with two satchels of money. His name is Leon Trotsky, on the way to St. Petersburg. He is stopped by the Canadian government because they didn't want Trotsky getting to St. Petersburg financing Lenin, because if Trotsky got to St. Petersburg and Lenin was successful, Russia would withdraw from the war, releasing German divisions in the Eastern Front to kill Canadians in France. Not very smart, was it? So the Canadian government put Trotsky in jail and confiscated his money. But Woodrow Wilson put such pressure on the Canadian government, they were forced to release Trotsky, return his money, and ship him to St. Petersburg to finance the Russian Revolution, to sign the separate peace treaty of Brest-Litovsk, to release German divisions to go to the Western Front to kill Americans at Chateau Thierry and Belleau Wood. Just the same old game we get in Vietnam today, isn't it? Well, while that show was going on, let's move on to some other little things. 1922, Nobel's are nicely knocked out. And things are coming along real good. By the way, 1920, let's take a look at now oil production. 1920. Washington oil production, 2.8%. Under 3%. That took care of a competitor very nicely, didn't it? Lenin was doing his job, as he always was, a visible hireling. Stalin might have got a reasonable bit of independence, but Lenin was always a total puppet. Visibly so. For an example here, a couple of years ago, the president of Chase Manhattan Bank, which you would normally think of as a capitalist, wouldn't you? And something the communists would hate. The board of directors of Standard Oil, David Rockefeller, who should be number one hate man in the world of a communist. You would think so, wouldn't you? Where does he take his vacation? In the Kremlin. Isn't that the place where the number one capitalist should take his vacation? In the Kremlin. It's interesting, when his vacation is over, so was the term on Nikita Khrushchev. Khrushchev no longer was premier. Now, I say this is just circumstantial. I can't prove there was a connection between the two events. But I think the boss arrived and didn't like what was going on at the outpost. And so we relieved the command and put new people in charge. Something made him unhappy. Well, anyway, let's go to 1922. Things start getting a lot of fun. In 1922, we had another pullout of money and another bank crash. The money was taken out to Canada again. We had another crash. By this time, notice what happened. A man named Will Durant, who owned a little company called General Motors, one of the wealthiest men in the world, in 6 months was wiped out, and the DuPonts moved in and took over GM. Pierre DuPont, becoming president. Notice something. There are 1,600 millionaire DuPonts. That's a quiet sleeper outfit. And the ones you don't hear about much, watch them. If you notice in any political operation, the guy who doesn't do much talking, sits back with a cigar, really runs the show. The guy up front with a gavel, he's the puppet. What is really decided in the convention is decided the night before. The rest of you people who are delegates, you can kind of come and go along with the show. Because you got to have the eye wash for the public, don't you? Does anybody actually think that in any convention you really do pick the nominees? Quite absurd. But 1922, the DuPonts took over GM. They almost got Ford Motor Company. Ford was back to the wall, and Henry, who was a real hard-end fighter, this is the old Henry. Not that simpleton who he... New Henry hasn't got enough brains to really do anything. Outside, he's got enough money to... Well, we'll leave Henry alone, I guess, for the time being. Maybe we'll get that going later. Old Henry knew that they were ready to take Ford Motor Company. They had him in a box. Couldn't get out. Just like they had Durant. Durant ended up slinging beer in a tavern in Flint, Michigan when he died the rest of his life. And he died there, a poor man as a bartender. By the way, the big General Motors building in Detroit was originally, if you look up in the stonework, it's got a big D's in the stone. That was the Durant building. He just built that thing for his private office. A pretty huge operation. Well, Will Durant, they chiseled a lot of the D's off and made it the General Motors building. Anyway, what did Ford do? Ford swept up every bit of his plant, bought all the supplies he could on credit, built every car he could, ran out every lump of coal and every nut and bolt, laid all the workers off, sent them home, shut the plant down, shut the whole operation down, forced the dealers to buy every car for cash or lose their franchise. And cashed out the company, paid off all the debts of Ford Motor Company in one fell swoop, and opened the plant without a penny's worth of debt, and didn't borrow a penny as long as he was president of Ford Motor Company. Till 1948, he never borrowed a cent from a bank in the world. In order to do his little banking that he had to do, remember, Ford Motor Company is the only company in the world with a AAA credit rating. He opened his own bank, called the Wabik Bank, to make sure that Manufacturers National. Wabik was GM's bank. To make sure you wouldn't have to deal with any bankers in any of his operations. By the way, on his birthday in 1922, to show that he got away, he produced 100,000 cars as a birthday present to himself. All with no bank money. They pulled off the game at that time. They grabbed a few companies. But now the show shifted. They were in a new game. Let's watch the new game. It's called Stock Market. You know, you buy it, Parker Brothers, $298. Only they got a big model. It's called Wall Street. Watch this operation. They started buying stock at relatively low prices. The stock market wasn't an important thing up until the mid-1920s. In fact, in 1911, there were only six industrial companies even listed on the New York Stock Exchange. The rest were all utilities and railroads. They started buying at relatively cheap prices, large quantities of stock, and then some interesting things happened. In the human interest parts of our newspapers came advertisements, only they weren't listed as advertisements, but human interest stories. How this shoe clerk, now living at the Waldorf Astoria with the stuffed bear cat and lots of gals and a raccoon coat, made all of his money in this magical thing called the stock market. Now, you just put 10% down. If the prices go up 10%, you make 100% profit. Magic! What an easy way to make money. Everybody's doing it. Prices are going up. There's a whole new boom, industrial boom, opening up with no limit, no horizon. Prices are going up, and you just invest 10% down, and you make 100% every time the market goes up, only 10%. Everybody's getting rich. Everybody's doing. Everybody's buying. Nobody's selling. I'll tell you something. Somebody's selling for everybody buying. You see, I figured that one out. Now, watch the game now. What they did play down in these nice human interest stories is the fact that you also mortgage your car, your life insurance, your house, and everything you owned. And if the market went down 10%, you lost 100%. And if it went down more than 10%, you lost everything. Well, don't worry. It's all going up. See, don't let these little worries bother you. So the market goes up and up and up and up and up and up. And October 24th, 1929, every bank in New York withdrew all money from the stock market and from the money market. Interest rates went to 1,000% per day on short-term cash. That meant the stock market couldn't operate. As soon as this was announced, every broker knew what it was. The big boys had pulled the plug. They've sold out. So the brokers rushed on the floor trying to sell their stock. They wouldn't even answer the telephone for the num-nums out in the countryside. And, of course, the window dies and the horse. But somebody had sold all of that stock that had been bought by people 10% down. But notice, who picked up had the mortgages on the houses, on the cars, on the savings accounts, the insurance policies? Why the very same boys? Now, they wouldn't have planned it that way, would they? Gee, golly. They wouldn't do that. So, anyway, everybody wasn't buying. They were supposedly selling. Now, the market started down on October 24th, 1929. And by the way, that day arrived in the gallery on a visit from England, a man to witness the crash at the very hour of the crash named Winston Churchill. So he could be there for the show. I guess they wanted him to show him what power they had and brought him over for a little display. Be sure that he saw the game and knew where the marbles lay. Okay? So the American people got a little milky. But let's watch the game now. The market starts down October 24th. Now, the youth today are kind of told it crashed overnight. Well, it didn't crash overnight. It did for people 10% down. But the market started on a steady decline until April 14th, 1932. On a steady decline, falling 95% to 5% of its previous level. Now, that's a pretty good fall, isn't it? It fell for 30 straight months. Why did it fall 30 straight months? Why were there no recoveries when prices looked cheap compared to old prices? Well, there were attempts at recoveries, but every night when the market would turn up, three men in the United States would pour across short sales, selling stock that didn't exist, putting up hundreds of millions of dollars worth of collateral behind these sales. And these men, you see, a short sale, the person putting up the money is known. So therefore, the people really behind these sales could not be known. Otherwise, it would be known who was manipulating the market. These three men were obviously nothing but hirelings, people who didn't worry about their reputation. The man doing the major portion of the sale was the number one bootlegger in the United States,
The number one gangster, the man who run his own fleet of gunboats out of the 3-mile limit, who controlled the New York liquor market and the docks, a man named Joseph P. Kennedy. Old Joe wasn't worried about his reputation. He figured he'd buy that back later. You know? So old Joe was out there. By the way, he got his old liquor business back, didn't he? Remember when they took off prohibition, he lost his liquor business. So now he got it legally. He got a total monopoly on all imports of all English, British Isle liquors, Scotch, Welsh, Irish, and English liquors into the United States forever. He gets 25 cents a bottle on every liquor, bottle of liquor imported in the United States, no matter who imports it. How does he get that? By competition? By service? No. By government monopoly. That's where the Kennedy money comes from. Anyway, and he got that show back for doing a good, you know, this is a payment for a good job well done. And service of the right people. Oh, Joe knew where the thing was. Here was a hoodlum that came up and played with the right boys and pocketed his money. He was a smart guy, though. He knew never to socially himself muscle in. See, some of these people don't know that. This clique does not want you to muscle in socially. It's all right to work, it's all right to get some money and so forth, but just... And Lyndon Johnson knew that, too. He knew how to keep a proper separation. But anyway, some of the boys don't, we'll talk about later. Let's see, April 14th, 1932, it hit the all-time bottom. And this April 14th, 1932 was the lowest month of every economic indicator in the history of the United States, the very bottom of the Depression. Where was the second lowest month in the history of the United States? May 1938. That's an interesting day. Roosevelt had been president 5 years. But let's get back and see what happened. Enter stage left, Bernard Baruch. Bernard Baruch now financed another fellow for the presidency, a man named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, and after he was elected, before he took office, Bernard Baruch admits to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's son-in-law that he personally had bought 5/16 of all the silver in the world and held it in his private account. That's a third of the entire world's silver supply. The first act of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as president was to double the price of silver to help out Western miners. But Bernard was advising the president and was an elder statesman, which makes him an uplifter of the downtrodden. He was thinking of the nation's poor miners. You understand that? So, while we got that little show going, let's take a look at some other... You notice this history is a little different than you get down at the public school, doesn't it? But in the 1930s and late 20s, a major oil producer was being developed in Mexico by independent oil companies. But in 1936, the president became a Mexico and El Presidente, who was an avowed Marxist. He nationalizes an industry. You want to guess which industry he nationalized? You're right again. And Mexican oil production fell way off. But now let's jump along after the 1936 bit and watch some other show. You had a problem. Bernard Baruch was playing around with silver, but the other boys were playing with gold. I'm all of the people here, I know we have been indoctrinated so heavy, and many of these things, they become emotional. I mean, names and personalities are something we've been indoctrinated to the point, oftentimes, we cannot even objectively look. To many people, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a god. I don't believe there's ever a politician who deserves anywhere near that kind of esteem. I'm sure of that. He was a man capable of all of the sins, shortcomings, and weaknesses the rest of us are. He didn't weigh much more. He didn't weigh as much as I did. And I'm sure that he was nothing but flesh and blood like everybody else. And just as easy enticed. Now, let's take a look and see what this man did. Now watch. You're told, and we're told, that gold is going overseas, aren't we? That there's a great outflow of gold. Where does gold go when it goes overseas? Oh, by the way, I didn't get to it. Let me digress for a minute. Back in 1919, the Rockefellers were setting up this little organization called the CFR. I told you about some of the presidential candidates.
Well, it seems that every president of the Federal Reserve Bank since 1919 has been a member of the CFR. Of the executive committee of five men, three of them are Rockefellers. Now, the CFR also has members like the head of U.S. Steel, Blau, major heads of our college, major universities, and particularly of the big giant industries, and very interesting, in our State Department, every Secretary of State since James Bond, for an example, has been CFR. In fact, the CFR brags and can prove that our entire foreign policy is established by the CFR. Because our State Department is in total control, and has been since the Second World War, in the hands of the CFR. Now, what is the Council of Foreign Relations' purpose? Their purpose is to bring about a one-world sovereign government. Now, let's understand what a one-world sovereign government means. If you are for a sovereign world government, you must be against sovereign national governments. You cannot have sovereign national governments and a sovereign world government. One must be sovereign or the other, but both cannot be sovereign. If you have sovereign states, you can't have a sovereign federal government. If you have a sovereign federal government, you can't have sovereign states. Your sovereignty can only rest in one level. Sovereignty has to rest at some level. Therefore, if you are for a sovereign one-world government, a sovereign United Nations, you must be, therefore, against a sovereign United States. Seeing the Constitution of the United States establishes a sovereign United States, that's exactly what it does establish. Any person who is for a sovereign one-world government is for the overthrow of the Constitution of the United States. Richard Milhouse Nixon says he is for the sovereign United Nations. This means he is for the overthrow of the Constitution. Lyndon Baines Johnson says he is for the sovereign United States. Dwight David Eisenhower was for a sovereign United Nations. I said, I think I got Johnson backward, didn't I? He was for a sovereign United Nations. Truman, for a sovereign United Nations. This means that they are idealistically committed to the overthrow of the Constitution of the United States. They were elected to be president, not of the United Nations. They were elected and hired to a job by the American people to be president of the United States. Being for a sovereign United Nations is grounds of impeachment. Alone. Under law. Let's take a look at some other things. Up here in the top of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the Federal Reserve Bank as far as we're concerned, because that bank is the controlling bank of the national banking system, there is up here in the office a man, president of the Federal Reserve Bank, who happens to be also CFR. Now, across the street, there's another bank called Chase Manhattan, where David Rockefeller on the board of the CFR sits. Now, the foreign banks hold their gold deposits. They don't take them out of this country because you might lose them, they might sink and all this sort of thing. What they do is they have bank accounts or vaults in the basement of Chase Manhattan. When gold goes to England, it goes out of the basement of Federal Reserve Bank, across the street, and down into Chase Manhattan basement. When gold goes to France, it goes on across in the France vault. Sweden, it goes on. Now, not the government doesn't own the gold. The banks own the gold. It isn't going to foreign governments. It's going to foreign somebodies. Okay? Now, this basement is considered not in the United States by law. When you have a law against holding gold in the United States, that doesn't count for gold in the basement of Chase Manhattan. Okay?